Okay. Well, as we look at this, once again, there's someone here Sunday morning. Can somebody give me just a few words as to why we're Jesus studying this period of what happened after the end of the close of the Old Testament and before the opening of the New Testament writings? So why are we here? Why are we thinking about this?
A lot of change occurred.
There's a lot of change that occurred. We got Sadducees, Essenes, Zealots. We got all these groups, Pharisees, all these groups that are on the scene when the opening of the New Testament writings, not even heard of at the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, couldn't get them to obey the law for nothing, as the saying may go. But by the opening of the New Testament, not only are they obeying the law, would they intermarry with the pagan nations? No, they wouldn't even befriend those of the pagan nation. Anyone who wasn't a Jew was a what? Gentile. Gentile was not a term of endearment among them. So really we're studying this, as we're looking through this period, we've used this chart from Daniel chapter 2, the visions of Daniel chapter 2, chapter 7 and 8, as our outline, so to speak, of it. We had the Assyrians, it was even before this, but after the Assyrians, in the days of the Babylonian king, the Babylonian king was the one that had the vision. And Daniel was the one, not by his own power, but by the power of God, that interpreted that vision for him. And he was lucky enough to say, "O King Nebuchadnezzar, you are this head of gold," which made him befriended, was at least in his best interest to be able to say it. And then who was the kingdoms that was to come? He was prophesying of Babylon and then four more kingdoms that was to come. Who are they?
The
Medo-Persian. After them comes
Greece.
The Greeks, and after the Greeks come?
Rome.
The Romans. Okay. And the Greek and the Roman is what we're going to be looking at today. What was it Philip of Macedonia was noticing toward the end of our last study? What was he noticing about this Medo-Persian Empire? What's that? It was coming weak. All the infighting, all the fighting amongst themselves for power and control, it had become very weak. And as we close the class out, Wednesday night, who had just been born?
Alexander the Great.
In the night he was born, there was a bright light in the eastern sky that we later found out was the burning of the temple. So who was this Alexander the Great? When he was 20 years old, he became the leader of the Grecian Empire. But he was educated at his feet. He had a personal tutor. It would always be very nice to say that, yeah, Aristotle, that was my personal tutor. He was my teacher. He was the one that pretty much raised me and educated me in the ways. Now, what come on the scene with Aristotle, Socrates, Plato? What come on the scene at this point?
Knowledge.
Knowledge. Greek philosophy, Greek culture, the amphitheaters. All of these things are beginning to come on the scene. We're going to see in this study how it's beginning to infiltrate the Jews in Israel in Judea, the little land of Judea. He was educated. He was a brilliant man. They said that accounted as a genius on most standards. He was also something else. He was also very impulsive, which was also one of his main success stories. A lot of his victories came because of his impulsiveness. He was a study of the mystics, probably going back to the Greek culture, so a lot of basic idol worship. But he was a mystic, a scholar. He was one that you would think would look like the king. He would look like a ruler. He was, you know, kind of like they said of Saul, that, you know, didn't want it, but was handsome and he looked the part. And he becomes king at age 20. Though it might be foreign to us, you know, think about the 20-year-olds in the congregation here to become king. But not only did he become king at 20, we find out that he was also a very good warrior. Found out that his father had passed away, or father had died, and at 20 he becomes the leader of the Hellenistic or league. Okay, so as we look at Alexander and his work, we're actually going to kind of do it from the map. Alexander the Great, as we said, was known as a very impulsive fellow. Shortly after he was announced to be the king, the area of Thebes, and it's kind of hard to see, but it's down in this area, a lot of the Hellenistic cities was saying, okay, we're scared of the Medo-Persians, we're scared, they're going to come in here, this Grecian Empire is over. They begin to revolt. Well, he picks his heap. He picks Thebes. And he goes in and just totally annihilates the city. Burns it, destroys it. And what do you think that did for all the other cities that were thinking about revolting? Hey, maybe this Alexander the Great ain't such a bad guy to follow. If we follow him, maybe he won't come in and do the same to our city. So he held the Hellenistic League up in this area back together by going in and destroying that one city. And everyone come and fell in line. And he becomes the commander-in-chief. Well, about this time, there's a story told that as they're up in this area, that the Persian forces are across the river from Alexander. And they're beginning to taunt Alexander. And they're taunting the Greeks. And, well, when most people get ready to go to war, this side gets their forces ready, the other side gets their forces ready. Well, Alexander, in his impulsiveness, says, okay. They start taunting him. He jumps on his horse and just starts riding and wading across the river. His men start looking around like, what's going on? Well, all they can do is they jump on their horses and start following him. Not because he had not more men, and not because he probably had a better army, but because he so impulsively and so quickly attacked the Medo-Persians, they walked across and began to slay them. And that was his first victory. It was after this that they began to win these battles, and as they're coming through this area, it was said that these Macedonian forces could march so fast and for so long of a period of time that they could outlast the messengers that was going back. And this time you didn't have phones, you didn't have any other way. Messengers is what's carrying the message of there's an army coming to attack. Well, these forces were marching at such a fast pace and for such long periods of time, they were known to be able to outdistance these messengers that was going. Well, it finds out there's a little city here by the name of Issu, right in this area here, that Alexander and his forces, they're marching through, and they're headed this way, obviously coming over here toward the Persian, Medo-Persian Empire. And he finds out that, no, they're not ahead of me, but the Persian forces are behind me. So they turn around and they begin battle here. Well, you got the ocean here, you got the Mediterranean Sea here, and you got mountain ranges up in here. So not only was he able to go in and actually the attack and the battle began with Darius the Third, but Darius the Third in the heat of the battle begins to flee. Well, when the commander flees, what does the troops usually do? They usually start running. They're looking for cover as well. But the thing was, this mountain range, there was only a very small pass that you could get through in this area. And so it pretty much was just a slaughter. The Alexander and his forces, they take this whole mountain pass, and as these forces are trying to flee, Alexander just basically it is a massacre as they go through. Alexander treats Darius' wife properly. He treats her with respect, but he goes in and bathes in one of Darius' tubs, showing that, hey, I've taken over this land, I've taken over this area, it is mine now. Darius flees, he's still alive, he flees away, but for all practical purposes, he's in control here. Well, he decides he's just going to come on down, and he begins his way down the sea. Obviously down here is Judah, so as he's coming down, the next place he comes to is Tyre. Well, he comes to Tyre, and Tyre had been destroyed before, and then they built their city where? Out on an island, just a few miles out. Well, he comes in, he pretty much, you know, goes in, offers them the ability to surrender, but obviously a city of this, they have their areas, they will not consider surrendering. So he says, how do we take them? Well, he gets his engineer and he says, okay, I want you to build me a bridge 200 yards wide out to him. If it had been a deep, if this water up in here had been deep, it would have never worked. But basically from the rubble of the original city of Tyre, he takes and starts and takes the rubble. The chief engineer takes the rubble and begins to build a bridge and begins and continues and continues. Well, they build the bridge all the way out. Something Nebuchadnezzar had tried to do for 12 to 15 years and unsuccessful at doing. Alexander the Great built the bridge out, surrounded, and went in and took great battle. He takes Tyre. And what do you think he might, from last class, what did he get with Tyre? When he was able to take and conquer and take the island of Tyre, what was stationed there?
Navy.
The Navy was stationed there. So with that, He took control of the navy. Everyone that would give allegiance became part of his navy, and the others were considered pirates, or basically war was declared on the ones that were considered pirates. Well, with this, he continues to travel south. Most of the places through here, you think they're going to try to stand in his way? Not really. I mean, they're pretty much here. And a lot of them even thought of him as the Savior because they were pretty much tired of this Medo-Persian reign. And he comes down, there was one small uprising in Gaza, and we know Gaza's in the southern part of the land of Judah, down in this area. He goes in and he puts that out, and he comes down into Egypt. And even in Egypt, he's received as a Savior. He's taken and received as a Savior, and everyone receives Alexander very, very well. And then he realizes at this point that everything's in control. He has control, but he will not have ultimate control until Darius is dead. So he goes back up and engages in battle again until that he finds Darius, and this time Darius is killed in battle. Well, it's said of Alexander the Great that he would have gone as far as possible, but his men decided when he got over here to India, all of his warriors and all of his men said, "That's far enough. You know, we've gone as far as we need to go to the east. We're stopping here." So because of that, they turn and they come back this way. And as we get back up toward the Tigris and the Euphrates, where Babylon would originally have been, Alexander falls ill and then ultimately dies from the illness. And they said he had pretty much had a severe drinking problem by this time, that he falls ill and dies. Well, with his death, his generals, under the guise of saying, "Okay, we're going to take care of his heirs." He had a mother by the name of Olympus, his wife, he had one unborn son at the time, and then a half-brother that was said to be retarded. So at that time, these generals say, okay, they under the guise of, "We're going to protect his offspring, we're going to protect the kingdom," but what do you think these generals were really doing? They're beginning to battle for power. So the one that was actually to be the guardian of these heirs, hey, he's going to have too much power, so he was assassinated. The next one that come in and took his place, well, he was assassinated because he was getting too much power. And by the time you get to the third one was tired of the assassinations happening, so he just kills all the heirs and makes himself the ruler. And at this point, we have Cassander as the ruler. But it really doesn't stop it. All of Alexander's armies and generals are all battling one another for the ultimate control at this point. So all of this land, through here, the battles begin. Well, after a lot of fighting, they finally sign a peace agreement of Ipsus, and which would have been that same thing to come back up here where it would have been signed. But at this point, there are basically three major areas. We're going to be concerned about two of them. But Philip of Macedonia, he's taken this area up in here back toward actual city of Greece and Athens in this area. And we have Seleucus that would have taken the Syrian Grecian Empire, and Ptolemy that would have taken the Egyptian. Well, if you look at Egypt here and you look at Syria here, what do you think Judah's going to be? What's that?
Either or.
Exactly. They're supposed to belong to this one. Seleucus was actually one of the commanders of Ptolemy's army. So, in the agreement, Syria was supposed to get Judah. But, because he was once subservient, or one of his generals, Ptolemy takes it, and he doesn't necessarily battle that much. But the entire time, probably 20 times during this period, our true area, Judea, is, for the most part, the battleground. They change hands between these two empires probably 20 times during this period. So they're in this constant state of battle. However, during Ptolemy's rule, the Egyptian rule, Ptolemy, for the Jews, was a very good thing. He did not enforce the Greek culture and religion upon the Jews. He allowed the Jews to continue the worship as they wanted to worship, which obviously befriended the Jews to himself. To the point that Egypt was very open, to the point that many of the Jews even moved to Egypt. So you start seeing these pockets of Jews, and we talked about synagogues, places of worship. You start seeing them spread out. this point, you're seeing them spread out into into Egypt, and later we'll see them over into Rome and to Italy as they begin to spread out. But the Egypt was very open to the Jews, and they allowed them to come in, and they settled, and they were very peaceful. They were allowed to continue their worship as they had done. So, in about 280, Ptolemy's was in the way of the Greek culture, wisdom, knowledge. He decided and builds the great city of Alexandria and decides that he wants this huge library. Well, one of the things he'd become interested in and become intrigued in might be what? If you're thinking about history, what might he enjoy hearing about and finding out about? The Israelites and this Hebrew manuscripts and these Hebrew scriptures that they have. So, with this, there's a council, they say, there's actually a legend that 72 men in 72 days translated the Old Testament into Greek. But regardless of the legend, whether it be true or whether it be false, he did put a council together, and the Septuagint version became known, which was the Greek translation of the Hebrew scriptures. Now, that word Septuagint does mean 70, but what do you think was some huge effects of this? Of now having what was the Hebrew language, or the Hebrew scriptures, in a Greek translation.
More people could read it.
More people could read it. The Greeks were a more educated people. The common people, and a lot, even more of the common people, would have been educated. So now you have more than the Hebrews, and by this point, a lot of the Hebrews had even lost their own language. So now the scriptures is written in a language that not just the high priest or the elect of the Hebrew or the Jewish nation could read, but now it's written in a language that a lot of people can read and a lot of people can understand. Do we have any hints from the New Testament that the Septuagint was actually accepted by God?
Yep.
What would that be?
Jesus quoted from it.
That's right. And even a great majority of his quotations actually was quoted from the Greek scriptures. Or the Septuagint translation. And Mike and I was talking after services Wednesday night. The scriptures come into Greek at a time with a very powerful language, very descriptive language, and in a language that most of the people knew. So now God's word, God's scriptures, of how he brought the people to this point, prophesying of this kingdom to come, is now come to a language that a lot of people can know and a lot of people can understand. And we can see how that can set the scene for Jesus to come on the scene here in a couple of hundred years. So, at this point, we're going to leave his control under, leave the Jewish control under Ptolemy's, and then after a few wars, after both Ptolemy's dies and Seleucus dies in the north, their next generation, the battles begin over control again. And this time, Antiochus of Syria takes over the ownership. They die, the fighting begins, and now Judea is back in Syrian's hands. Well, at first, everything seemed well. They continue to be a pawn between these two countries, between these two leaders, but politically it was peaceful for a while. Antiochus didn't come in and create a lot of trouble for them. Most people, by this point, they're learning and adapting the Greek language and the Greek culture, and this is one of the things that Antiochus wanted to do. He wanted everyone to be a part of the Greek culture, but he didn't force it at this point. He was looking for ways to introduce and to enforce the Greek culture. Now, who would be ruling? Who rules during this period of time of Jews? In the Jewish area, who would have been their ultimate ruling class? The high priest, or whatever is known of the high priest at this time, would have pretty much been, it would have been the high priest role that he come in and he strengthened, and he's continuing to rule through that high priesthood role, but they are the ones that are in control. Now we begin to see Rome come on the scene. We talked about Greek. Rome's not the world power at this point, but they're coming on the scene. Well, they have three Punic Wars, and I'm going to switch over here for just a minute. The first Punic War was over, here we go, give my orientation here. Carthage, down here, at North Africa here, there was the war between Rome up here, Carthage down here. Well, the first was a naval war over Sicily. And Rome takes that battle. After the victory, they claim Sicily as theirs. And then Carthage comes over here into this area, which is Spain. You got Spain, Gauls, and then you get over here in the northern area of Rome. They come over into here. Rome has an uprising against them, but Hannibal, their leader, was able to put that revolt out and lead some of the... They were kind of training centers over here. And he's able to lead troops over in here in the area of Gaul, and now they're sitting up here at Rome. Now, what do you think this Carthage leader, of Carthage general of an army... Rome probably is, you know, they've already had the battle with Carthage down here. They've gained this area. They're battling against them. And now they got Carthage here and Hannibal up here. They don't like it very much. So in that third, toward the end of the Second Punic War, they just come down here and they attack Carthage itself. And they're having a pretty good battle. But in order for Carthage to save itself, they recall Hannibal. So in other words, they relieved this pressure that they were having from the north. And Hannibal has to return. But it was in about 149, during that third Punic War, that they pretty much are destroyed at that point, and Carthage is wiped out. So, those three wars. Rome is trying to grow. They're growing west at this point, not east. But Philip of Macedonia comes in and helps the Carthage upset Rome in that battle. And file that fact away. You think Rome appreciated that? Nope. A little bit later, Rome will remember that. They were trying to help Carthage, and because Carthage might take care of Rome for them. So, at this point, we're beginning to see the Syrian-Grecian Empire is beginning to have trouble. They're calling on these other people from the east, and are calling on the other people to help out, trying to help Carthage out so they'll take care of Rome. And, let's see, here's... You can't see it. I was thinking I had another map here, but... Here is, you know, if you think about the map continuing to extend, they've got Rome on this side, off to their west, and over here they have Parthia, which is a nation that has kind of popped back up, or the Persian nation, and they're giving Syrians trouble from this side, Romans giving them troubles from this side, and it's not working out very well for them at all. So we're beginning to see the Grecian Empire beginning to crumble, we're seeing the holes form, and we're seeing them fall away. Now, as we said, all of this is going on all sides of Jerusalem. Our main focus is back in Jerusalem. Well, high priests are serving as the leaders at this time. The high priest is the leaders. And the sad part is, they're not really spiritual leaders as much as they're political leaders. If they would have been spiritual leaders, you know, it's going all the way back. God would have been happy. At this time, we are in a years of famine. That was to see if everybody was awake. Nobody laughed, so it must not be. We're in years of salmon from the Word of God. But we're in years of famine where there is not the Word of God. But these are not spiritual leaders, as we think of the high priest should be. But these are political leaders. There's two brothers. Yeah, Onassis the fourth and Jason. Well, they're both brothers, and they both want to be high priests. So not only this political infighting that's going on in Syria and going on in Rome, guess what? Jerusalem is not immune to this. Well, these two brothers both want control. Jason wants control as well. So they're beginning to compete over the high priesthood. Well, at this point, they're paying tribute back to Syria. So Jason is sending the tribute to Syria. But in addition to the tribute, he's actually sending just a little extra money, i.e. called a bribe. What does that tend to do with the rulers when you're sending them just a little extra cash? Because remember, at this point, Syria is having to pay penalties, war penalties. They're having to pay tribute as well for the wars they lost. So Antiochus said, okay, well, if you're going to give me the tribute and give me a little more, okay, you win the battle for high priest. So he puts Jason in as the high priest. Well, this didn't go over very well. Jason was one that really wanted to bring the Greek culture in. Now, the true Jews, or the pious ones, would have hated this. And they did hate this. They really didn't want the Greek culture coming in. He built a gymnasium, to where a lot of the people that would, as was known in the Greek culture, a lot of the people that would have been competing in that gymnasium would have been almost completely naked. So this just upset everyone in the area, and they really didn't like Jason at all. the pious ones or the Pharisees, as it will later be known, would have been much more for the brother. But, well, as you go and as you, as the way goes, he hits it by sending a bribe. Well, his servant is the one carrying the tribute back and forth. So he is taking Jason's tribute to Antiochus. Well, guess what? He said, well, if he paid him this much more to get to be the high priest, if I was up ante a little bit, what might Antiochus do for me? Might make me the high priest. And that's exactly what he does. So what was Jason's servant now has been announced as the new high priest. So now Jason is out. And Malinus comes back, and his first two objectives: one, kill this brother; two, kill this brother. In other words, take competition out. He successfully kills him, and Jason's able to flee. Jason flees away and escapes being put to death at his hands. Well, a period of time comes. We're actually focusing in on Jerusalem at this time. But Antiochus goes in, even though Rome had said, do not attack Egypt. Egypt is a friend of Rome. Don't go in and attack them. Antiochus had gotten into a battle and gotten into conflict with Egypt, had gone into Egypt, and they was waging war. Well, Egypt or Rome sends a letter by one that was supposed to be Antiochus' friend and said, tell him to get out. Well, and he comes and he greets him, and he thought he was greeting a friend, and the guy said, no, here, he hands him a scroll. He extends his hand to shake. He's given a scroll. The scroll says, you're being told by Rome, get out of Egypt. They're friends of Rome. And he said, let me go back and consult with my advisors. And the circle is drawn around Antiochus and said, don't leave that circle before you give me the answer. So he had to make a choice. Do I get out of Egypt and let this battle go? Or do I continue to fight it and face the wrath of Rome? He decides to leave. But during this period of time, false word comes out that he had been killed in battle. So Jason, who had been tried to be killed, obviously wants the high priesthood back in Jerusalem, decides he's going to go and lead a revolt. And he does. Because the people don't like him. The people didn't like Jason very well. But the Jews do rally around him to put Menelaus out as the high priest and put Jason back in. This worked very well, except for one small problem. Anybody know the problem? This was a false word that came that he was dead. Antiochus came back and got word that Jason and this uprising had happened, and he come in and made havoc of Jerusalem. He come in and took the city. One of the things he wanted to do is insert Greek culture in. Well, this he was having a hard time with this, but when this happened, he was able to do it. He comes in, he pretty much wipes out the city, knocks a hole in the wall, sets his own fort up in the middle of the city. He builds an altar to Zeus on top of the altar of burnt incense. Think about what this is doing to the Jewish people. They're getting even more intense. This is going on. He takes many of them and sells them as slaves. There's huge amounts of bloodshed. And he takes over the temple and he says, okay, worship to Jehovah is now illegal. You must worship Zeus. And in Greek culture, who would Zeus have been? The ruler, you know, Antiochus. He would have been Zeus. And by name, he took on the name of Zeus. So he says, we're going in and we're going to wipe out their religion. And anyone who was against it would have been put to death. So, there was a man by the name of Matthias that they come to this older city of Modin, and they found this older priest by the name of Matthias. And they told him, bow down and worship Zeus. Offer incense. And the old priest said, no, I will not do it. And they found another Jew over here close by and said, okay, well, you. And that younger Jew or other Jew said, yes, I'll offer the incense that at their force. But before he could offer the incense, Matthias takes a sword and kills the young Jew that was going to offer the incense, and then kills the two soldiers or the soldiers that was trying to force it to happen, i.e. revolts his own hand. This is known. This is the beginning of a huge revolt, trying to kick this Zeus worship back out of the land. When he refuses and he starts this revolt, well, obviously Syria is going to come in and squash out the revolt. Well, Matthias he takes a man by the name of Judas Maccabee, as we know is the Maccabean revolt, and he says, you're the military leader. And he takes his son by the name of Simon. And he says, he's the oldest son of five, and he says, you are going to be their advisor. So Judas Maccabee, which his name means hammer, and we'll find out in a minute how, and then his oldest son is the advisor. So the revolt is on. Let's see, Judas Maccabee, the warfare they led, they pretty much go into the city and the villages by day and infiltrate and look like anybody else. But at night, they would come out and attack the Syrian forces. And though they were outnumbered, they had huge success. And they were causing major trouble for Antiochus and this Syrian forces and the Syrian army. And this revolt was in full swing. They tried to put it out. You've got the Matthias and these forces. They're looking out to Rome for help. Rome is sending aid because Rome's anything against anything that would hinder or crumble just a little bit more of the Greek Empire Rome is about. So Rome is helping the Maccabeans, giving them extra aid, and the revolt is full swing. Well, even in addition to this, we had stories where these Syrian forces would come in. They would find a thousand pious ones. And pious ones is what become later known as the Pharisees. That, what would they fight on the Sabbath day? No, they would refuse to fight on the Sabbath day. So one day, 1,000 men was slaughtered. And this Judas, Matthias, the high priest, come in and said, no. If you're attacked, even if it's a Sabbath day, if we're attacked, we've got to revolt. We've got to protect ourselves, even if they're attacked on the Sabbath. And he gets this revolt going. So, third time, just another chip, and another chip, and another chip. Well, after Antiochus' death, Judas and the Maccabeans, they regain control of Jerusalem. They're able to destroy this Zeus worship that's going on, and they're able to kick it out. Well, and in all of this, we have the beginning of Hanukkah, which was the Festival of Lights, and that was just basically after the Maccabeans had kicked out the Greeks out of their land. The temple had been cleansed. They had taken and tore down the altar of Zeus, rebuilt their walls. They took the altar out as well and built a new altar of incense that had been polluted from the idol of Zeus. When this was done, Hanukkah, the Festival of Lights, was born, where all the Jews burned candles in their windows at this time. So, this revolt keeps going, and it keeps pushing them further and further out. Catch up in my notes and make sure I didn't leave anything necessarily out. Judas Maccabee, he was killed. I mean, he had great success. He was killed he and his brother John were killed in battle in about 160 B.C. Jonathan, another brother, became the leader, and he also became the high priest. And then he was later murdered. So Simon, the one that was the original advisor, is the last one of the sons of Matthias that is actually alive. And he is the remaining heir. And it was in this time, after the death of Antiochus, that Demetrius Seleucia, the king, had decided, okay, we can't beat these Maccabeans. They're taking us at every hand, so we're going to get out. Well, when they got out, the pious ones, or the Hasidim, or what is later known as the Pharisees, thought success. They thought the Maccabeans should stop right there. We've got our religious worship centers back, so we should stop. But the Maccabeans at this point wanted the full political independence, and they kept fighting. To the point that even after Simon was assassinated by his son-in-law, the rebellion was put out, but his son, John, became the ruler of Maccabees and the high priest of Jerusalem, as well as the ruler of this independent nation. So now let's actually take a break and let's look at some of these groups that have come out of this. We got the Hasidim. We even still see some at least by name, some ones known as that in certain areas. They were known as the pious ones, also later known as the Pharisees. We don't know when they began, but they're the ones that began to build these traditions around the law. By the time we see the Pharisees, they would keep the law by what? They built these hedges, these trims around the law, that if we didn't break one of these oral commandments, We wouldn't even get close to breaking the law. And they thought that their obedience would oblige God to bless them. That sound familiar by the time the New Testament comes on the scene? If we're obedient enough, then God owes us these blessings. The high priesthood had become so corrupt, as we just learned with Jason, with the others. The high priesthood had become so corrupt that they viewed themselves as priests. We've got to take this on. But everything became a ritual. There had to be a method. There had to be a way of doing everything. So whether it was praying, whether it was fasting, whether it was washing of hands, everything was defined and everything had to become a ritual. And do we see these traditions as the New Testament pages open? Yes, they're in full swing at that time. These become the traditions that Jesus is rebuking. These oral commands that were wrapped around the law. They built rules around the law, and their oral traditions to them have become as binding as the law itself. So, with that, growing out of this group would be the Pharisees that we know today. They begin to become at odds with the Maccabean Revolt, or what would become known as the Sadducees. Their names meant the separated ones. They separated themselves out. We're nothing to do with those Maccabeans. They're only wanting a political problem. We have our temple back and our worship back. We should stop now. So from the very beginning, they were known as, they were at odds with the Maccabeans. And the Maccabeans is what would grow into the Sadducee group, which was a strictly political group. But there are, as we know in the days of Paul, the straightest or the strictest of the sects of the Jews. So this is when, at least the first known, that they come on the scene. So we have the Pharisees, and not their good friends, the Sadducees. The Sadducees was much more political. They were politically minded rather than spiritually minded. They were of this Maccabean revolt. They wanted their independence back, and that's really all they cared about. They didn't believe in these traditions, these rules that were being built around the law. Now, do we see in the New Testament pages, do we see the disparity between the Pharisees and Sadducees? Yeah. And we see how even Paul took advantage of that. They didn't look forward to some future obedience actually giving them some blessing. And they really didn't even believe in resurrections, angels, or life after death. It was all political. It was all physical to these guys. And then we have the Essenes. The Essenes was one that they started, but they really didn't have much to do in society because they were the ones that went off into the wilderness by themselves. They're, you know, the monks, the monasteries. They went off by themselves. And then you have the Zealots. The Zealots are the ones that came in. And who is probably the most popular zealot in New Testament history?
Simon.
One of the apostles. What were they thinking? What were they looking for?
The physical kingdom
to come back. They knew that there was, they, but give it to them, that they'd read the law, they'd read the prophets, there was this kingdom that was coming, and they were going to set out to make it happen by brute force. And that was the Zealots. The Sanhedrin Council. Once again, it's the beginning of time, nothing. Some say it dates back to Moses, but the name is Greek, and there's no mention of them in any sacred laws, in any sacred writings. So I'm very doubtful that it dates that far back. Probably came in about 202 in this area, 202 BC, is the first time we know of them. But anyway, they go back before the Roman Empire, and by this time, the New Testament, and they, by the time of the New Testament, they are the court of law, as long as it doesn't break Roman law. So now it's all about the Romans from this point. And Rome is the area where Jesus comes into play. We'll hit some highlights here. But Rome is the area where Jesus comes into play. And we've got to our fourth kingdom and pretty much to the end of our study. You see that the Roman Empire covers a lot more land. Almost all the way. Any would have been back over here. But here's this Parthia that was causing them trouble. So they wanted about 50-mile strip over here. Once again, Judah finds themselves to be this barrier between two countries. They're that palm, that trading palm back and forth. Everybody wanted to control this because they had control the Mediterranean Sea over here to this side. So, as Rome continues to watch them, the Syrian Empire weakened. They've been giving political aid to these guys. They hated the Parthians, and they knew that Parthia was giving Greek problems for the West. They decided by 75 BC, they were in complete control of Asia Minor and that entire area, and really Jerusalem as well. And they wanted this 50-mile strip of land. And so after the assassination of this particular high priest, they who had taken his father's place, they did something that we see, and the last thing I want to make sure we get before we break apart is they subdued the Idumeans, which is who? That's right, the Greek name for the Edomites. And this guy in particular, he goes in and takes the temple out of Samaria because they hated the Samaritans as well. But after his death, and I'm actually going to skip a little bit ahead. Once again, they're still at odds with the Pharisees and the last one here. Antipater is the one that comes on the scene. He is one of these Idumeans. And he is one of the ones that, even though Jerusalem is this little land that's constantly in battle, constantly the pawn, he befriends himself to the high priest, but more importantly, he befriends himself to Rome. And he is the father and the grandfather of who that we see when the New Testament comes on the scene? Herod the Great, yeah. Herod the Great that's ruling when John the Baptist is born and also Jesus is born. He comes in, even though he's an Idumean, which you think an Idumean ruler, does that make the Jews happy? No, it doesn't make the Jews happy at all. But once again, he did a lot of good things to the Jews. He got their freedom back. He got some of their independence back. But he helped when Pompey was being chased into Egypt. And he helped in that battle. And when he helped, the rewards were sent back to him. And he was made the ruler. And then his son Herod became the ruler of Judea after that, when it was in Roman control. And then a little bit later, you know, this is the Herod the Great that is there when the New Testament comes on the scene. And even though the Jews didn't like being under the control of the Idumeans or the Edomites, that was how it was. Okay, I think that's almost everything. I think I skipped just a couple of points about the Jews itself. But we do see a lot of things that have happened here. We see the political climate for when the New Testament comes on the scene. And I hope this has kind of helped tie from the period of the prophets. All the prophecies, the prophecy of the silence of God's Word, all the way to the prophecies of their punishment, of their desired return, and that promise of what was the prophets keep promising of, what was coming?
Messiah.
What's that?
Messiah.
A Messiah is coming. You know, this other kingdom is coming. This kingdom that you can be a part of, it is coming. And all of this stuff is continuing to take place in those years between the Testaments. So, thank you for your time and your attention. And sorry I didn't give many people time to talk today.